All right, is the thingy working? Can you hear me at the back, more or less? Yeah, okay, I'm getting some thumbs up from the back. Thanks, Mike, for that introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. I guess before I get started, let's see, what should I say? I know most of you are used to hearing scientists or physicists talk at these colloquiums, although I'm told the last one of the year is sort of traditionally a little different, so I promise to try to make this one a little different. I am a journalist, so you know I don't actually have like a PhD in physics. I have a bachelor's degree, which is great. I do, of course, spend my free time talking to scientists. And so I rely on you guys. So I in a way kind of think of you as colleagues. I could not do what I do if it wasn't for you guys. You guys make discoveries about the nature of the universe, and I go and tell people. They used to joke that I don't feel this way about even a particular majority of scientists. They often say that scientists aren't good communicators, right? They often say that. I don't think it's really true. I mean, Galileo was a great communicator, and Einstein wrote books about relativity, and these days there are a lot of best-selling books written by scientists themselves. The only problem for me is if you guys get really good at that, then I'm out of a job. So I hope at least some of you need a little help getting the message out there. So I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground, and it will be a mix of physics and philosophy and psychology and a few other topics. So let's plunge right in. I think time is one of those things that seems very fundamental. It seems like a very important part of our universe. There's a quote from Aristotle from 2,300 years ago that he says, as long as I'm aware of anything, I'm aware of the passage of time, even if I close my eyes, turn out the lights, and so on. I still think that some time has passed. We don't know, of course, exactly what was going on in the minds of our Stone Age ancestors, but it's probably safe to say that they were captivated by the cycles that are seen in nature. Now, that would also count biological cycles, but it's the cycles you see in the night sky that are the most pristine, the most precise and predictable. And certainly when we look at some of the first artifacts that humans have left behind. This is a very intriguing little artifact. I wish there were more of them. This one actually seems to be just about unique. It's a fragment of a bone from the wing of an eagle, I think. And I know the photo's not great, but you can see it has these little notches on it. Someone has been marking it for some reason. The anthropologist who looked at this object in the 1950s, a guy named Marshak, he sort of said, well, look, they're not random. They're sort of in rows, and if you count up the number of notches in each row, it's about 15. Well, you know, two 15s, that's like about 30. What else is roughly 30? The lunar cycle. So maybe this is a Stone Age lunar calendar. Oh, so I got to have to toss in a quiz question here, but very quickly. Shout it out. Phase of the moon today? Okay. Particular holiday being celebrated today? Anyone? Easter, no. Try again, anyone? I hope someone in the back said Passover. That's great, yeah. Coincidence? No. The Jewish calendar is linked to the lunar phases. And the Christian calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is actually still a lunisolar calendar. Almost nothing in the Christian calendar has anything to do with the moon, but one holiday does, Easter, which can't just be any old Sunday, and it's not just any old Sunday near the spring equinox either. It's the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox, except not exactly, but it's very close to that. And if you tell people that, they'll believe you. It's almost true. And I have more on that in chapter two. But anyway, so maybe our Paleolithic ancestors were keeping track of the lunar cycle. When we look at the first structures that people built, they were at least partly motivated by a desire to keep track of what was going on in the sky, the celestial comings and goings. Stonehenge is the most famous. There's an even older one that I'll get to in a moment. A lot, of course, has been written about the alleged alignments between various pairs of stones at Stonehenge and various celestial events. It's all a bit tricky because, of course, if you have enough stones and enough celestial events, you can always find some sort of an alignment. And that's why most of what's been written about Stonehenge is probably wrong. But the one thing that everyone does agree on is the main solar alignment involving the central axis. Now, in this artist's rendering, north is at the bottom, just so that you can see inside this central horseshoe-shaped feature. These are the great trilithons. You can see this one's partially fallen over. This one here has also partially fallen over. But this horseshoe shape does define an axis, like so. And if you were to stand here and look through this axis, and in fact you'd pass another stone that's off the edge of the diagram called the heel stone, and you could sort of use that as a kind of a gun sight, and if you're there as the sun rises on the longest day of the year, the summer solstice, you would in fact see the sun rising out in that direction. And if you want to, of course, you can do it the other way around. You can stand over here, wait until December and the shortest day of the year, and you can watch the sun set on the winter solstice, and much fewer tourists gather to watch that, but it does work both ways. So again, a lot has been suggested about, people have figured out ways to say that they weren't just tracking the sun, they were tracking, you know, the extreme moonrise and moonset positions, maybe. There are these little holes around beyond that, the circle you see there, 56 post holes called the Aubrey holes, and someone said, well, you know, you can use these to actually predict lunar eclipses in a certain way. Well, the thing is, of course, yeah, you can use it to do all kinds of things, but did they? And we just don't know. So as I say, this solar alignment does seem to be unambiguous. The rest is all a bit up in the air. Newgrange in Ireland is actually a bit older than Stonehenge. As you can see, it's a wide but kind of shallow mound. It's actually a burial chamber, so it's hollowed out inside. It's about 80 meters across, but only about a dozen meters high. A stone is thought to have blocked the entrance. It has these interesting spiral pictograms on it. There's actually nothing like that seen at Stonehenge, so it's sort of interesting. On a side note, I sometimes, write about this sort of thing, and people ask me, well, are you really sure they had no writing? Did they not leave behind any messages about what they were thinking when they built these things? And the answer is no, unfortunately, no writing. There were cultures at around that time in southeastern Europe that did have a fairly sophisticated written language, but no, nothing like that in northwestern Europe. This was in sort of a state of disrepair up until the 1960s when archaeologists did go in and had the first thorough investigation of the site and then did a very nice restoration. So it is now thought to look pretty much as it had looked 5,000 years ago. Do take note of this funny opening here. It's called the roof box. It's above. Here's the main entrance. Here's the roof box. And you'll see the significance of that. Here's a cutaway diagram. So here's the burial chamber in the center of the mound that you saw in the other diagram. This side view, this is the top view. So you can see you go in, it's a long narrow passage. It branches out sort of three ways at the back, like a cruciform sort of design. And the significance of the roof box, you see it here, is that as the sun rises in December on the winter solstice, sunlight briefly shines through here and illuminates the rear of the chamber. And in case you're wondering, well, that seems like a lot of work to go to. I mean, what was wrong with the front door? But the passageway does slope gently uphill. So any sunlight that comes through the entranceway actually just doesn't get anywhere. It just hits the ground. So it's only sunlight shining in through the roof box that illuminates the back of the tomb. And as with Stonehenge, everybody seems to agree that this particular alignment is too much. It's not a coincidence. The people who built Newgrange had this goal in mind. For whatever reason, we can't say, but maybe it had something to do with the importance of the people who were buried there, important members of the tribe, chieftains, or something like that, that they would have this honor. Well, since then, of course, we've gotten better and better at keeping track of time and slicing it into finer pieces. Sundials are quite ancient. They appear in Egypt, at least in the 4th millennium BC, maybe a bit earlier. By ancient Rome, they're everywhere. And there's actually a nice quotation from a Roman playwright named Plautus saying something to the effect that he's very angry with whoever invented the sundial and started putting them all over Rome, because now he feels pressured all the time that these sundials are chopping the day up into little bits, and he feels like he's always in a hurry. So he's kind of upset about it. Yeah, well, and so if you ever feel that way, it is not a new feeling. So what do these machines do? They're all an attempt in some way to mimic what goes on in the heavens. In the case of the sundial, it's sort of a straightforward reflection, so to speak, of what the sun is doing. Clocks do it, well, in a way better, because, of course, as soon as the clouds come or at nighttime, the sundial stops being functional. But mechanical clocks, as long as you remember to wind them, will keep going forever and ever and ever. And I think as long as we have these clocks sort of humming along, there may be a kind of a tendency to imagine time as this sort of steady, linear progression, just kind of chugging away without, you know, without regard for anything else. And I sometimes do a demonstration with a tape measure, which I'll spare you because it involves two people to hold the ends of the tape measure, but you guys have this awesome meter stick that from the look of it is actually a couple of meters long. And I'll just make this brief analogy between time and space. Now, we all know that meter sticks measure space and not time, and yet there is sort of an analogy to be made, because this idea that time is a thing that just keeps going by does suggest a relationship to space. There's kind of some subtle points here which will come back to haunt us a few times over the course of this talk. Einstein, of course, showed an intimate connection between time and space. But there's already some sort of a connection, isn't there? Because when you say the store is 5 minutes away, you're automatically saying that, you know, if you pick a speed, then there's a connection between space and time. So there's some kind of a connection automatically. And, of course, the funny thing about time is that you seem to be trapped in a particular point, which we could call now. This is the arrow of now. You should all have one. But, of course, it doesn't just sit there. It sort of moves along and along and along. And you can either say, well, that's so obvious it's not worth pointing out, or you can argue with it and say it's not true because it ignores various aspects of modern physics. But regardless, I think there is a possibility that our habit, that we've spent the last 1,000 years or so watching the hands on our clocks moving by in this sort of steady way, maybe forces us to think of time as doing this kind of progression. And in some audiences, I mean, there are too many physicists here to do it, but in some audiences, I ask them, you know, do you sort of picture time as being something like this? And almost everyone says they do. I'll spare you guys because you know too much. But now, of course, this is around the time, so in the first accurate, the medieval clocks weren't particularly good. They could gain or lose 15 minutes a day. Pendulum clocks are much better. This is the sort of environment we find ourselves in when Isaac Newton comes along, and I make a little segue here into the physics. So Newton writes down this very famous definition of time, which in fact kind of reflects what I was doing with the arrow and the meter stick. He uses this kind of flowery language, but he's saying it's absolute true in mathematical time, without reference to anything else, flows uniformly. And that word flow is also perhaps a little bit problematic, so we'll come back to it. The Principia is kind of a funny book. I suppose some of you have read bits of it. I hope no one's read the whole thing. It's kind of unreadable. It doesn't really matter if you're reading it in Latin or the English translation. I mean, it doesn't make... I've read little bits, too, but I certainly haven't read the whole thing. So it's a funny sort of definition, and before he gives the definition at the beginning of the book, he says, well, he actually says, I don't need to define space and time because these are well known to everyone. But then he does actually give the definition. And then he sort of says, he backtracks and says, well, here's why I'm explaining it. He says he wants to distinguish this sort of true mathematical time from what he calls the common time. Well, what's the common time? That's the time that you might read off a sundial or a clock. And these things are, of course, are known to be imperfect. Clocks, as I mentioned, were pretty inaccurate in Newton's day. You might think to yourself, well, again, not you guys, because you know too much physics, but you might think to yourself, well, what about the sundial? I mean, that's pretty good, right? It's just telling you what the sun did. But the problem with that is what the sun does as it moves across the sky is imperfect, too. So we live in the northern hemisphere, so the sun, this is so good to do with a laser pointer, it saves me from drawing lots of diagrams. The sun rises somewhere over here, goes up here, crosses the local meridian, and then I won't blind anyone, but it goes down there in the west, right? I am pointing south here, I think? Yeah, okay. Well, doesn't it just move at a uniform rate? Well, of course, those of you who have taken introductory astronomy classes know it doesn't for a couple of reasons. And, I mean, I'll spare all the details, but it's partly because the Earth's orbit around the sun is actually an ellipse. So our speed going around the sun varies depending on what time of the year it is, and this, in turn, affects the rate at which the sun appears to move across the sky. And also, the Earth's axis is tilted with respect to the ecliptic, the Earth's orbit around the sun. So even though you might think, well, the sun is just gaining a little bit of right ascension every day, if you just take that into account, but no, because at some times of the year, some of that change in right ascension is lost to a change in declination due to this tilt. So both of these factors make the rate at which the sun moves across the sky non-uniform, and so even if you have a great sundial, what you're measuring is not a uniform steady progression. So Newton understands this. He probably understands this better than anyone, and he imagines that these these sundials and mechanical clocks are struggling to mimic the real time, the real mathematical time, the real time of the mathematicians and philosophers that he figures is sort of looming in the background. So that does perhaps seem like common sense, but of course there are difficulties, and as soon as he wrote it down, people started to object. One of the first objections, the kind of thing a philosopher might say, but really I guess anyone could say this, does it make sense, can time be measured other than in relation to the motion of objects? So Newton is assuming that time is fundamental and that this arrow that moves along the meter stick just does that, and it really doesn't matter what else is going on in the universe. But other people, like Leibniz over on the continent, said, no, it only makes sense to talk about the passage of time if you've already established that there's a universe in which there are objects and the objects are in motion. If you have motion, then you have change, and then you can say, aha, now I can start counting intervals of time, now I can say time is passing. So Newton doesn't see it that way. Newton thinks that time is paramount and change is sort of something else that you can build on top of that. You don't have to take sides right now, but you can think about this argument, which of course persisted really for quite a few centuries. Another objection, which sounds a bit funny in the 21st century, but it was a pressing problem back then, was time passing before God created the universe. See, back then they didn't have buses that said, there's probably no God, relax and enjoy life. It said there probably is a God, be very worried. So this is the kind of thing that Newton and Leibniz argued about. It does raise the question. You see, they all agree, they were all believing Christians of one kind or another. Newton actually had he subscribed to a sort of a peculiar branch of Christianity that was rather unorthodox. It denied the divinity of Christ and it denied the Holy Trinity, and that's not a good position to take if your employer is Trinity College. So he had to keep a lot of that to himself. So he's very careful about what he did publish and what he didn't publish, but certain things he had to, as a lot of you know, he was very obsessed with biblical matters and chronology in the Bible and predicting the apocalypse and dating events in the book of Daniel and stuff like that, but a lot of that he didn't publish and was only discovered long after his death. But he was certainly as interested in that as he was in physics. So everyone agreed that there was a creation event, right? God created the universe at some point. Now, in Newton's view, this happened at some sort of point in time, but of course his enemies and people who see things a bit differently are going to say, well, hold on, there's a bit of a problem there. What was God doing, right? It means he was waiting around, I guess, for the opportune moment. And there's actually a correspondence between Leibniz and actually not with Newton himself, but with an English theologian named Samuel Clarke, who was sort of a disciple of Newton, and Leibniz said, no, you basically brought up this argument. I mean, what are you saying? So God created the universe at like 5 o'clock, but why not 4:50 or 5:10? It makes no sense. And philosophers have a name for this. It's called the principle of sufficient reason, which is that God wouldn't do something on a whim, because that's not how gods work. Gods do things for a reason, and this would seem to be an event that doesn't have a reason. And Newton didn't really have a comeback to that other than to say, well, look, sometimes I guess that's just the way God does things. So again, well, you can see which side you prefer. So Leibniz's conclusion is that God must have created time together with the universe. This argument, it doesn't begin with Newton and Leibniz, and it doesn't end with them either. Augustine, writing, 1,000 years earlier, had come to a conclusion fairly similar to that. And it's reflected to some extent in the modern scientific version of this argument that has to do with the Big Bang and what came before and stuff like that, which we'll try to get to. So there will be more physics. I do want to segue a bit and talk about language and culture, partly because I was hesitant to put too much physics into this talk, because you guys all know more physics than I do. But also because you spend all your time reading physics journals, maybe you haven't been able to read the latest stuff that's been in the psychology and linguistics journals and stuff like that. So we'll have some fun with some of these items. It's interesting to look at how a child starts to learn language and how a child begins to deal with concepts like past, present, and future. And you can see you know, as the child gets old, you don't have to read all the details, but you know, young children only have a limited ability to envision past and future. Choosing delayed gratification, this is, I don't have kids, but if you do, you can, well, I guess the first thing that people do if they have kids is they swear that their kid reached these landmarks before the expected date on which they're supposed to, I've heard. But at any rate, delayed gratification just means, turning down a small treat now because someone has promised a bigger treat later on. Younger children can't do that. Around the age of six, they can, talk about yesterday, today, and tomorrow, count down the days to Christmas or some other holiday. Later on, seeing time as an abstraction, which I think is an interesting point, and I read somewhere that children under the age of 15 don't sort of get daylight savings time in the sense that they think that when the clock is turned ahead an hour, that hour has actually been lost. I, as best I can remember, I actually got that around age 13, but I don't know. Maybe I was, maybe I was 15. I don't really remember. But I mean, I read it in some journal. But it's, as I read this, I started to think to myself, and this is based on studies of Western children. But I started to think, well, how much of this is culturally dependent, and what happens if you conduct a similar study in a non-Western culture or someplace where time is seen a bit differently? I came across this quotation from a local psychologist. Children under four may not have the linguistic representational skills to conceive of time as a dimension. Here we go with the meter stick again, going backward and forward from the present moment. Well, this is interesting. Why must a child think of time that way? This is what I want to know, and I don't really have an answer. It's just something you can think about. Are we hardwired to be Newtonians? I haven't really seen anyone address that, but it did seem to be lurking in the background of those studies. I'm not sure that if you just, that this a child's ability to see time as a dimension going backward and forward from the present moment is really a universal thing that would happen independently of where the child is being raised. That's something we can think about. Comparing our culture to some non-Western cultures. And these are just, it's not a survey, I'm just mentioning a few sort of intriguing cases. The Umida people of Central New Guinea are an interesting case. They don't track the lunar cycle, which is extremely unusual. Almost every culture does. So there's no month, and there's no market cycle, at least not of the sort that we have. So there's no week in the traditional sense. But they do count days, and they count them relative to today. Now, what does that mean? It means, well, if you ask someone here what day it is, there are seven different answers you can give, six wrong ones and one correct one. But the Umida only have one answer. It's today. It's always today. But they are aware of yesterday and tomorrow, and they can do better than that. There's the day before yesterday, and there's the day after tomorrow. There's actually the day before yesterday, and the day after tomorrow. So the anthropologist who sort of did an investigation there said in the Umida culture, so to speak, it's always Wednesday. It's interesting. It's both a departure from our way of seeing things, but also, in a way, not that dissimilar. There's a distinction that philosophers, this guy named McTaggart was writing in the early 20th century about the difference between the A series and the B series of time, and I forget which is which. It doesn't really matter. But one of them is where you mark events as being absolute. You know, here's the Battle of Hastings, and here's World War II, and here we are, which is one way of tracking time. But the other way is just to tag things relative to today. You know, something happened 3 days ago versus something that's going to happen 10 years in the future, and keeping track like that. And of course, that's what the Umida are doing, except in the limited sense that they're not looking either backwards or forwards more than this interval of 3 days. Now, I think this makes it hard to plan for things that are going to be more than 3 days away, but I suspect they don't do that sort of planning very much. So it's fascinating, isn't it? It's different from our way of looking at time, but again, not radically different in that we also judge things by how far away they are removed from today. Someone's got their hand up already. All right.
Do they have any annual holiday?
I don't know. I mean, is it agriculture? You know, I'd have to go back and read up. So I'm not sure if they're hunter-gatherers or if they're doing agriculture. Well, I don't know, but I mean, it sort of parallels the challenge of counting for cultures that don't have a complex counting system, right? You can use words like many to to make up for the fact that you don't know what the higher numbers represent. So I don't really know the answer to that. I'd have to read up. I suspect that, of course, they do have, you know, their brains are the same as our brains, right? So, I mean, they do have memories. And they have, what's the word for it? There's episodic memory. There's, you know, psychologists have shown there are links between remembering the past and envisioning the future. And I don't think that would be any different for the Amida people. But nonetheless, the way they sort of keep track of things is kind of different. The Aymara people of the Central Andes region are another interesting case. And here it's about the way they gesture. And we all gesture. I was at a conference watching Lawrence Krauss interview Brian Greene about the nature of string theory. And Brian Greene gestures all the time. He can't talk about string theory without either going like this or something. And it was great. Now, and I do it too, right? We all do it. But when we do it with regard to time, how do we do it? We talk about future events. We gesture in the forward direction, right? So if you ask a first or second year undergraduate if they've thought about graduate school, they'll say something like, oh, you know, please, that's down the road. I'm not going to worry about that. And similarly, if you ask someone, are you still mad at Bob for what he said in 2003 or something like that, oh, please, you know, that's water under the bridge, and they'll point behind them. So that's how we do it. The Aymara do it the other way around, and the word they use when they talk about the past is the same word they use when they talk about things that are in front of them, but also for sight and for their eye, for things they can see. And when they talk about the future, they gesture behind them. I know my diagrams aren't very good. They'll have to do. Anyway, the anthropologist who studied the Aymara people, of course, was very puzzled as to why this would be the case, and he has sort of a theory. I mean, it's a little hard to prove, but past events. What are past events? Past events are things that you may have seen. They're things that you may have witnessed with your own eyes. So maybe that's the connection to eye and to sight. So these are the things you have concrete information on. So there's kind of a link there. Whereas the future, what's the future? The future is something you can't see. The future is something you don't have direct knowledge of, in just the same way that I guess you don't really know what's behind you. So this may be the reason that they gesture behind themselves when they talk about the future and in front when they talk about the past. It does seem to be dying off. I mean, there are actually about 1 million Aymara speakers left in the Andes, but the younger generation who are fluent in Spanish gesture the way we do. So it does seem to be disappearing. So these are interesting variations, and there's more examples that we could sort of chat about. But in spite of all these variations, it doesn't seem like it seems that what unites us all is stronger than what divides us. This quote from Alfred Gell: "There is no fairyland where people experience time in a way that is markedly unlike the way in which we do ourselves, where there is no past, present, and future, where time stands still or chases its own tail or swings back and forth like a pendulum." So it's interesting. The variations are certainly there, and but nonetheless, we do have the same brains. The neurons are, I guess, moving around differently, but we really do have a lot in common in terms of picturing time. Okay, I have to come back to the physics, because otherwise we'll go down that route forever. And I am skipping over a bunch of other things: second law of thermodynamics and entropy and whatnot. It is in the book, but you guys know all that thermodynamics stuff. So, skipping ahead a bit to Einstein and relativity. So as you know, Einstein's theory comes in two parts. Special relativity is a refinement or tweaking of Newton's laws of motion that becomes necessary when speeds are close to the speed of light. And the second part of his theory is an improvement or a tweaking of what Newton had said about gravity, which becomes relevant when you're near a strong gravitational field. And it's, in fact, a new way of picturing time, because Newton had pictured time as a force acting over a distance between massive objects, but Newton sees it as a warping or a curving of space itself, actually space and time. So I know you know that. So I'm going to talk about some of the implications of Einstein's theory, not all of them. This is only a partial list. I'm just sort of focusing on a few things that really relate to how we picture time. So, of course, space and time become linked. As I mentioned earlier, that's not news, but it's the fact that they're very intimately linked in a very specific way that Einstein showed. Time measurements depend on speed. Now, this is something that Newton would have had a hard time adjusting to. Because in Newton's world, things just happen when they happen. There's an event somewhere in the universe, and you can it has an unambiguous location along this grand timeline of the universe. So he wouldn't have thought that the interval that's elapsed between one event and some other event could possibly depend on anything. Anyway, it turns out that, of course, he was wrong, and it does depend on how fast you're moving, how fast the things that are that you're watching are moving. So that would have been quite puzzling for him. Twins can end up with different ages. He would have had quite a lot of trouble with that because, again, twins are born at the same time, so you really wouldn't think that they could ever come to have a different age. Well, of course they can. And in some audiences, I've given versions of this talk to a lot of different audiences, and I can't tell you how cranky people get over this notion that twins end up with different ages. They really don't like it. And I'll give some examples later, and you know, and this is something else we can talk about. If there's nothing to say about the physics, because we all, you know, you're all read up, we can talk about like how to present these ideas so that you can actually convince someone who doesn't believe them to believe them. There's that whole thing as well. Gravity distorting space-time, as I mentioned earlier. So if you have a clock and you go near a black hole, you know, it slows down as seen by someone who's not near the black hole. The big one, I think, is the end of absolute simultaneity, the end of a universal now. So you all know what simultaneity is. If I go like this, I'm attempting to make these two events roughly simultaneous. And in Newton's world, they either are or they are not. If we have an observer somewhere who says these two things are simultaneous, then all observers everywhere in the universe will agree that they were simultaneous, and there's just nothing to argue about. But it doesn't work that way in Einstein's universe. There can be disagreements. Different observers can disagree as to whether event A and event B are simultaneous or not. So what's the implication of that? It really means, you know, in Newton's world, you could just take all the events that have ever happened in the history of the universe and put them unambiguously on this line, order them up, and, you know, that's basically it. There's this universal timeline that governs everything. But once you don't have an absolute simultaneity and you don't have an agreement over whether two events are simultaneous or not, this breaks down. And as Einstein himself put it, there is no audible tick-tock everywhere in the world that can be considered time. So Einstein really has taken away our arrow and our meter stick, and it's very unsettling. It seemed so good. It seemed like such a great metaphor, and now we don't quite know what to replace it with, other than I guess we each have our own little pointer and our own yardstick. In other words, our own clock. Well, this would have been a shock to Newton. And clearly his definition doesn't work. Yeah, well, okay, that's all right. That's too harsh. We'll give him an A-. That's fine. Yeah. So it was a great book, and everything in it makes total sense, except he really does have to go back and fix up some of those definitions that he had at the beginning. So it would be quite an adjustment. Another thing that would have been news to Newton, and in fact was news to Einstein at the beginning, was that relativity, the second part of his theory, general relativity, shows that the universe can't be static, can't be just sitting there. A lot of you know this episode of early 20th century history. Einstein, I think it was 1917, he started to apply his equations of general relativity to the universe as a whole. And he found that the equations are telling him that the universe has to be expanding or contracting. And he thought, well, that can't be, because everyone at this time thought that the universe appeared just as it had always appeared. So he puts in this fudge factor that he calls the cosmological constant. But within about a decade or so, Edwin Hubble and others are making measurements of distant galaxies and finds that distant galaxies are receding away from us. And not only that, the farthest ones are receding at the greatest speed. And it appears that the universe is actually expanding. And Einstein realizes he didn't have to put in the fudge factor after all. He calls it his greatest blunder. Well, actually, as we learned in the 1990s, the cosmological constant may be making a bit of a comeback. We don't have quite time to get into that just now. But it does. The consensus slowly built up from the time of Hubble's observations through to the 1960s when they discovered the microwave background radiation, that the universe as we see it today seems to have had a beginning. There does seem to have been this initial moment from which everything sort of unfolded. Well, of course, that does raise the question, similar to what Leibniz and Newton were arguing about 300 years ago, what came before the Big Bang? Did time exist before the Big Bang? Now, you've probably had other speakers up here giving colloquiums who could sort of address this a bit better, so I'm just going to give like the brief overview of some of the ways you can think about it. One argument I suppose you could make is that time just isn't defined before the moment of the Big Bang. This is a bit analogous to the way that North isn't defined after you get to the North Pole. And it's a satisfying argument in geography. Whether you like it for cosmology is up to you, I guess. But if someone, you know, when you get to the North Pole and you're, you know, every direction is south, and if someone says, no, there must be some place further north that you're not telling me about, well, they just don't get it, right? They don't understand what north means. But can you really, does this analogy hold up for cosmology? Can you say time wasn't defined before, before the Big Bang? Well, some people find it a bit unsatisfactory. Maybe time emerges from something else. From what? It's a bit hard to say. But maybe there's something a bit more fundamental. So time itself maybe is the sort of constructive thing, the sort of emergent property that becomes meaningful only when the universe gets to be somewhat like the universe we know. So in other words, you got the Big Bang, and then there's time as we know it. But maybe before the Big Bang, and it's very clear, our language is built to make this quite difficult. If I say before the Big Bang, I'm already making it sound like there was some sort of time going on. Anyway, maybe time emerged from something else, quantum foam, something or other. I simply don't know. And I mean, if anyone knows, that's great, because you can pipe in. Maybe there was a previous epoch of some kind. The critical question is, what exactly was going on? And I know you've had, I'm sure, speakers who have come up here and talked about eternal inflation. I think everyone knows what inflation is, so I don't need to get into that. But the idea is that, the universe we're in, of course, I've taken this diagram from one of Andre Linde's diagrams in Scientific American. So we may live in this sort of green inflationary bubble, and we think, okay, that's great, and here was our Big Bang. But of course, our Big Bang really was just the result of, of this previously existing red universe, and our universe in turn is going to give rise to this blue universe. And so really what we see is the Big Bang wasn't the beginning, and I guess if you go down to the yellow universe, you can ask, well, maybe this was the beginning of time. Well, you know, I don't know, maybe not. More recently, people like Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turek and others have talked about brain world cosmologies. This is a spin-off from string theory, in particular the latest incarnation of string theory called M-theory, where you know the strings could be multidimensional. And one possibility is that everything we see in the universe is sort of squished onto this brain of three dimensions, which for the purpose of this diagram is compacted down to two dimensions. And gravity, I'm told, leaks off, so there can be this sort of interaction between these cosmic brains, and sometimes they collide. And if they collide, there's a big release of energy. And if you're living in the aftermath of that, you'll look back. I'm not sure which way time goes in this diagram. It's either up or down, but it doesn't really matter. You can, if we're living here and you interpret this radiation, you say, oh, well, there was a Big Bang in my past. Well, that's fair enough, except this could be really an endless series of cycles. So maybe, again, the Big Bang wasn't quite the beginning. And when I talked to Alan Guth, one of the inventors of inflation, he said, I think it's clearly an oversimplification to view the Big Bang as the beginning of time. So there's clearly some more work to be done there. Okay, two more fun topics left. I guess I'll have to squeeze them in somewhat quickly. But time travel, because I know it would be a crying shame if I left that out. And then we'll have some philosophical puzzles at the end. Well, when we talk about time travel, the first thing to do is to distinguish, if it's possible, what about the pesky paradoxes killing your grandfather and all that? So that's really what we want to talk about, of course. We have to distinguish forward-directed time travel from backward-directed time travel. A time travel into the future isn't controversial. Again, I give this talk and people get all upset, but really it's built into special relativity that this sort of thing can and does happen, and that's just part of the way the universe is put together. I show this photograph of a time traveler to prove they exist. This guy, Krikalev, holds the world record for having spent the most amount of time in Earth orbit, a bit over 800 days. And if he had a twin brother, I don't think he does, but if he did and the twin brother stayed at home, when Sergei came back home, he would find that he is aged about 1/50th of a second less than the stay-at-home brother. Now, you can say to yourself, well, that's not very much, right? It's a very small difference. So it's not like you don't recognize your family members and things like that. I mean, everything, you know. So in a way, it's not a very big deal. And of course, I tell people, well, this has been tested with atomic clocks. It's been the fact that our GPS devices work relies on the fact that, you know, the signal between your GPS device and the network of satellites has these very carefully timed signals, and the people who write the software for these devices have to take into account the corrections for both special and general relativity, and in fact, your location would be off by like dozens of meters if they didn't do that. I mean, I tell people that to hammer home the point that this is like more than just a, you know, a story we tell, that there's really a strong amount of evidence going into it. But as I say, a 50th of a second is kind of small, so you know, I suppose you can just sort of pretend it's not happening or something like that. Here's a more substantial example from a writer named Michael Lockwood, so I just took his data here. He imagines a much longer journey going all the way around the galaxy at a very mild acceleration of 1g, so that's no problem. That's what you're all experiencing right now. Of course, if you accelerate at 1g for a long time, you do work up quite a speed. Not the speed of light, of course, that you're forbidden from that, but you do get very, very close to it, in fact, and that's great. It would take a lot of energy, so we can't do it, but theoretically we could someday, right? So you go halfway around, then of course you have to start decelerating, so you turn the engine around, and eventually you come back to your starting point. And you will swear that 23 years have gone by. And what that means is the cells in your body will age as though 23 years have gone by. If you start at age 30, you'll be 53 when you're done. If you take a stack of DVDs of all the episodes of Lost that you missed, you can watch 23 years worth of DVDs and so on. So that's what you'll think. But you come back, and it'll turn out that 150,000 years, approximately, will have passed on Earth. And so now it's worse than not recognizing your family. I mean, they'll be dead, right? And the best you'll be able to do is visit the graveyard where they're buried. Now, of course, it's too much to ignore. But it's funny, because when I give this talk, and people think this is either wrong or irrelevant, one or the other, maybe both. And then I give them this example, and they say, well, that's pie in the sky. We'll never be able to do that. So you've really failed to convince me that, well, anyway. But nonetheless, this is all true. Let's see. What was I going to say about this? Oh, yeah. So, of course, you can't really, exploit it because, yes, you can pick up the newspapers, go to the library, you can get 150,000 years of World Series results and stock market reports and so on. But, of course, to take advantage of that, you'd have to go back to where you came from, and that's the more problematic backward time travel. But having said that, you would be of great interest to any historians that you met because they would see you as this relic of an earlier age, and they would be fascinated by the funny way you talk and the funny way you dress. So there would at least be that. All right, so backward-directed time travel is of course, much more problematic. If it can be done, it presumably can be done because general relativity allows for curved paths, actually demands curved paths through space-time. You all know this. It's the old bowling ball analogy. I don't need to go over that. So anything moving through space moves in a curved path. But here's the question. Could such a path be so severely curved that it takes you back to your own past? And if so, what about the paradoxes? So physicists have a name for this. It's called the closed time-like curve. And people like David Deutsch and others have written it up in Physical Review D. But of course, we don't know that these closed time-like curves exist in the world. That's tricky. And different mechanisms have been proposed. There's, wormholes are the favorite. I suppose you could have cosmic strings that are moving around in a certain way. I'm not going to attempt to go over the different cases, although, I do get into it in chapter eight or whichever chapter it is. But of course, we'll plow on ahead to the implications. Because the really fun part is, so then what, right? If these closed time-like curves exist, what happens to causality? What happens to history as we know it? Doesn't everything get all muddled up? You all know the grandfather paradox, right? You're born, you build a time machine, you get in it, you go on some kind of a journey. Now you can argue with me about the way I've drawn this diagram, but it is a journey of some kind through space and time. And you come back into your own past where you meet Grandpa, who at that time is still a young man. And now I suppose it would be sort of evil to kill him on purpose to test the laws of physics. So we can say that you just didn't slow down from 88 miles an hour in your DeLorean and you simply kill him accidentally as you're coming out of the wormhole.
Excuse me?
Oh, yes. No reason that I can think of. And it could just be you. And you can also do it without people. You can have a billiard ball going into a black hole. They're all sort of the same paradox, and you're right. There's no particular reason why it has to involve three generations.
Work in the history of the literature about why that got chosen?
Not that I know of. Somebody just used this term, I think, like in the 1920s or 30s, and it stuck. Yeah, good point. So what happens after this? I mean, the paradox is self-evident because, if he's not born, your parent isn't born, and you're not born. If you're not born, you can't go into the time machine. So something has gone terribly wrong, and there are different ways that we can try to work around this. One of them, I guess maybe the most obvious or straightforward one, is to say that time travel into the past must be impossible. That is, the paradoxes themselves are the proof, I guess, that this backward-directed time travel can't work. And Stephen Hawking has given a name to it. He calls it the chronology protection conjecture. That is, he wants to make the universe safe for historians. But he does admit it is a conjecture. He doesn't know what it is. He's just saying that somehow the laws of physics conspire to make that kind of backward-directed time travel impossible. I think it's appropriate enough that I use the Simpsonized version of him here as opposed to an actual photograph. He was supposed to give a talk on Monday at the conference I was at in Arizona. He was sick, unfortunately. He's in a hospital in California. But his daughter was there. And he gave the presentation. I mean, we saw the slides and we heard the audio. And as the organizer joked, he was there digitally and genetically because of his daughter. Anyway, but it was still interesting. He argued that manned space exploration is vital and we needed to continue our species and so on. Anyway, here's the second way out, which is actually kind of subtle. And it's the idea that time travel is possible, but you can't change the past. Now, what does that mean exactly? It's not quite as simple as it sounds. So that means history has to be consistent. Well, you can't kill Grandpa because, of course, we know Grandpa didn't die. I guess you can try to kill him because as long as Grandpa goes around telling stories about how this crazed youngster came and took pot shots at him in the whatever decade, 30s, 40s, it sort of depends how old you are and so on. But if there was somebody who kept taking shots at him with a rifle, well, that's fine. Your destiny could be to be that person who was trying to kill him at that time. You just can't succeed in killing him. But it does raise some issues. I mean, why can't you succeed? Do you have a change of heart? Or, I mean, one writer was talking about this and said, well, of course, you have a photograph, so you know what Grandpa looked like at that time. You have the address, you go to the house. Of course, there could be something Grandma didn't tell you. This guy might not be your biological ancestor. Yeah, right. But it actually it doesn't help in terms of resolving the paradox. I had to think about this for a while. It doesn't help at all in terms of resolving the paradox because there can't simultaneously be that guy living to a ripe old age and not living to a ripe old age. It's got to be one or the other, right? Unless there's multiple worlds, which we'll get to. So the paradox remains. Maybe you pull the trigger and you miss, but the question remains, why would you miss again and again and again? Maybe you slip on a banana peel, and there's actually a paper by a philosopher, an Australian guy. It's about 20 pages long, and the title is "Bananas Enough for Time Travel." And it's getting at this question of can you slip on a banana peel enough times for this resolution to make sense? And his conclusion, to save you the trouble of reading the lengthy paper, is that it's the wrong kind of question to ask. I mean, yes. Pulling the trigger and missing again and again and again seems strange from the point of view of events that haven't yet happened, but if they're events that already lie in the past, see, this is where it gets very muddy, because you as the time traveler consider these to be future events and the rest of us see them as past events. This is really the heart of the problem. But if they're past events, then to call them coincidences is to mislabel them. In the same way, think of how astronomically unlikely it is that you would be sitting here in this auditorium from the point of view of, say, the Big Bang, because first the Earth had to cool, and then your grandparents had to meet, and you had to poke on the U of T website to see, oh, interesting lecture today, whatever, right? So it's very unlikely that you would be here. However, you're all here. So it's a bit foolish, this guy argues, to say now that it's unlikely that you would be here. It's just a fact about the universe. So slipping on a banana peel again and again and again would be strange if it was a prediction about a future event, but is really just a statement about the nature of the universe if it's already happened. Anyway, you may or may not find that convincing. So I was thinking about this, and it does raise the, first of all, your free will seems to be greatly compromised. because there does seem to be this restriction. You know, what is it that would cause you to miss when every, you know, presumably you should not miss? I was thinking, what if you go to some place where history has not been very well recorded? Then do you have total freedom? I mean, this starts to get a little crazy, but what if you went to the Jurassic era, the time of the dinosaurs, and you want to do, you know, something crazy on Mount Everest? Well, history doesn't say that that didn't happen, so I guess now everything's okay. But that's a very weird way of looking at things. And then I thought, what is the opposite of going to a place where you would have total freedom because things haven't been carefully recorded? And the opposite would be to go to some place where things have been very well documented. And I call this the Downing Street Dilemma. It was easier to alliterate Downing and Dilemma than anything with Sussex Drive or Pennsylvania Avenue. You get the idea. Because Downing Street is filled with closed-circuit television cameras, presumably everything that's happened there for the last 30 or 40 years is perfectly well documented. So let's say you want to do this very modest journey going back 5 years, right? So it's 2009, we want to go back to 2004. And let's, for the sake of argument, say you're 30 years old. So you say, aha, and you've built a time machine, or you found, it's always better if an alien civilization has built the wormholes already and you're just going to, you know, use them. And your destination is Downing Street 2004, and you think, I'm going to take a leisurely stroll along Downing Street in 2004. So, but before you do it, you figure, well, you know, what the hell? I'll go to the head security office and look at the videotapes from April 9th, 2004, just to check if I did this journey. And as you can imagine, there are two possible outcomes, and really they're not good either way. The first one is that you look at the videotape and you're not on it. So this, I guess, shows that you didn't take this journey. And by the way, I don't mean that if you're 30, you didn't take it at age 25 in 2004. I mean at age 35 plus a little bit, did you or did you not take the journey, right? Because we're not asking what you actually, you know, your regular self did in 2004. You were probably, like, you know, at home or something like that. There is, of course, the awkward case where you do it both times. That just means you'll meet yourself on Downing Street, age difference of 5 years. But that's highly unlikely. But anyway, if it shows that you're not there, then I guess that means you're forbidden from taking this journey. But if there weren't cameras on around the rest of London, does it mean you can walk around London as much as you want, and as you're coming down Whitehall, you're simply forbidden to make the turn onto Downing Street? That's, I think, an extremely weird state of affairs. Now, the other outcome is not any better. The other outcome is that you look at the videotape, and by golly, there you are. You're 30 now, and on the videotape, there are you, aged 30 and a little bit, 5 years earlier, having a walk down Downing Street. Well, now you're compelled to get into the time machine and take a stroll down Downing Street, but the problem is that every arm and leg movement, every eyeball twitch, must precisely duplicate what's shown on the videotape, and I think that's why our little guy looks so nervous, because he realizes that all free will has gone out the window, and he must do what the videotape shows that he already did. Well, I guess my point here is that it's sort of a comeback to the philosopher who wrote the 20-page paper saying, don't worry about it, strings of coincidences are the wrong description of this, and history just has to be consistent. I think there's some things that really are don't hold up very well in that argument. There is a third way out, of course. I'll try to wrap up as fast as I can. There's more than one timeline. And of course, this sounds a bit crazy, but there are some aspects of modern physics that kind of lead us in this direction. Quantum theory, going back to the 1950s, there's this many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, in which every time a quantum event happens, the universe kind of splits up into two or more. I mean, eventually you sort of get an infinite number of universes this way. I've already mentioned both M theory and inflation, but the point there is that, you know, although it sounds absolutely totally crazy, maybe it's not completely crazy because of these arguments from modern physics. So you can weigh this and decide which option you like the best. Okay, I'm just going to go through some philosophical problems, and then I'll wrap things up, and we can move to questions. That's just if the universe splits up, you get this new timeline. So no, I mean this is episode 3 of the Back to the Future trilogy. You know what I'm talking about. All right, some philosophical questions to wrap up with. And if anybody has to go, no problem. I know some of you have another class to get to. I'll just not a problem. Could the flow of time be an illusion? It is an interesting point that both physicists and philosophers have looked at. And what they found is maybe a little bit disturbing. When we look at the most common metaphors that we use about time, we say time flows like a river. That's something that you've heard from poets and writers of various sorts. I think we sort of take it for granted. I'm not sure how well it holds up. First of all, a river flows with respect to the shore. That's common sense. Time flows with respect to, right, you don't know. And you could say, well, maybe I think, you know, I'll postulate the existence of a hypertime and my time flows with respect to hypertime. But then you'll be wondering what hypertime flows with respect to, so you need hypertime and so on. So that's not very helpful. Also, at what rate does time flow? Well, you go down to the river with a bucket and you can say the river flows at a rate of a certain number of gallons per second. Well, at what rate does time flow? So, oh, well, I know it flows at a rate of 1 second per second, right? But you're all pretty good at math, so you know that you cross off the seconds and you're just saying that time flows at the rate of one, so that's not very helpful. So there are certainly some problems there. There are people like Julian Barber. Some of you know he's an independent physicist who works near Oxford. I mean, I should say he's not crazy. I mean, some independent physicists, I suppose, are a little crazy, but he actually has a PhD and is quite well respected in the field. He's published a lot on the foundations of quantum theory and that sort of thing. Well, he doesn't think time exists. He doesn't deny the existence of the now. He's got no problem with that. In fact, he says there's a whole lot of them. There might be an infinite number of them. What he doesn't like is the idea that they're connected to each other in any way at all. He believes that they're just sort of a static array. He calls them Platonia, after Plato's realm of the ideal forms. And so they all just sit there somehow in your mind. He doesn't know how, but somehow we sort of connect them up, and that's where you get this imagined flow of time. At the end of our chat, we had a nice long chat in his cottage outside of Oxford. I asked him, so what is time? And he says, time is a mistake the mind has made. I would say of time what Laplace said to Napoleon about God, I have no need of that hypothesis. It sounds more profound if you say it with an English accent, like a country gentleman. So he doesn't think time exists. Having said that, he was able to come and pick me up from the train station at the appointed hour. So he is somehow able to cope with the sort of everyday notion of time. Well, so you can say, all right, well, maybe Barber, you know, he's not on the faculty at Oxford. Maybe he's nuts, right? Maybe this is too far out. But, you know, I found this essay by a philosopher, just a mainstream philosopher at Harvard from the 20th century, who said something almost the same. Williams says, time flows only in the sense in which a line flows or a landscape recedes into the west. That is, it is an ordered extension. And each of us proceeds through time only as a fence proceeds across a farm. Well, that clears everything up, doesn't it? Right? I read this and I guess he's dead, so we can't really argue with him. But a fence proceeding across a farm, I mean, whatever it is that my consciousness does with time couldn't be less like, in my humble opinion, couldn't be less like a fence proceeding across a farm. For one thing, every part of the fence is just like every other part of the fence. And I would have sworn that every part of this is not like every other because I seem to be, at this moment, here. But maybe I'm wrong. So, you can think about whether this is satisfactory or not. There certainly are people, including physicists, who feel that perhaps there's something that's been left out. One example would be Lee Smolin. A lot of you know Lee. He lives here in Toronto. He works at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo. He's written a couple of books. And in one of his books, he says, we have to find a way to unfreeze time, to represent time without turning it into space. I have no idea how to do this. I can't conceive of a mathematics that doesn't represent a world frozen in eternity. So how far back we have to go, I'm not sure. I mean, if it's back to Galileo, all right. If it's back to, you know, sort of Parmenides and Heraclitus, then really we have to, that's a lot of work. Someone's got to redo all of Western civilization. I guess we leave that as an exercise for the student. So there you go. You can sort of weigh these options and decide for yourself what you think time might be. Thank you very much.